Hi, friend. You're listening to an exclusive episode of the London Lyceum, which is typically only available to subscribers. This is Kiffin's Keep, generally particular, the Hanover House, and any other exclusive episode that comes. As a small nonprofit, we rely on the generous support of our subscribers to help cover the costs that are associated with producing our content. So if you've benefited from our work in the past, we'd really encourage you to become a regular subscriber, whether that's the monthly donation of $5 a month or that's the annual subscription amount of $50. It's not just the podcast that you get access to. We make sure you get access to the PDF copies of our journal as well as other resources. So your support really does make a huge difference. Anyway, we appreciate you tuning into this episode. Hopefully it's beneficial to you and encourages you.
Hello, I'm Jake Stone.
I'm Jesse Owens.
And we welcome you to another episode of Generally Particular, a production of the London Lyceum. Generally Particular is a show dedicated to reflecting and discussing the whole Baptist story. We are a show by Baptists and about Baptists, as well as for Anglicans, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Lutherans. Jesse is an Arminian Baptist, and I am a Calvinistic Baptist. And in the 17th and 18th centuries, we would have been known as a General Baptist and a Particular Baptist. So we brought those together in what we think is a fun way to form Generally Particular. So here we are. We're still alive, but barely. And we're recording this December the 11th, and we apologize to our audience. It's been 2 months since we have recorded an episode. But if I could just for a moment tell folks that it is not because Jesse and I just don't have anything to do, but it is, this semester has been for me the most grueling few months I think I have had in life. I told somebody, you know, pastoring brings its own unique stresses and exhaustion. This semester, as I have tried to balance 2 degrees alongside my work, it has been a taxing season in many ways. But I got everything done.
I would say you look tired, but I think I look more tired than you do, so I won't comment.
Well, that's because I finished Sunday night. I got the last thing for my library degree for this semester done. And so I told somebody I have not opened a book and read anything this week apart from the Bible.
There you go.
Done nothing else. This week has been a lot of administrative stuff here at the library, and I said it has been a pleasant joy to just be working on pulling course reserves and doing more of the administrative stuff that I do, because I have not had to, you know, use my mind. I'll tell everybody this funny story. This is how I had come to almost the end of just feeling fried in a sense. We have here at the library a key box with our keys and stuff. And when you get hired at the library, they give you a code. And so, I mean, I was assigned a code 4.5 years ago. And, you know, after 2 times using it, I memorized it very quickly. But I keep a little piece of paper in my wallet so that I always have it, but I don't ever use it. And Thursday, I had a seminar last week, all day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So I'd finish that up at 5, and then I would work for an hour or two on work stuff here. And I had to go get a key out of the key box, and I walked down to the key box and stood there at it and could not remember my code at all. And so I had to get my wallet out and retrieve my little piece of paper, and I'm like, this is how I know I have come to the end here of my brain cells. So,
you knew, but this
I'm doing a lot. Yeah, but I'm doing a lot better because, like I said, it's been a little more of a chill week, and we're getting ready for more snow. Forecast is Sunday a high of 15. So
yeah, what all's going on in Louisville? Weather, Southern Seminary, what all's going on?
Well, Southern has graduation tomorrow, so it's hard for me to believe that this will be a year ago since I graduated. In some ways, it seems like last week, and others, 5 years ago. And but things are going well. The semester was very challenging for me. I experienced a sense of PhD boot camp. and realize how little I know and how much
I told you, you know, one professor that I had said, if it doesn't feel a little bit like hazing, we're not doing it right.
Yeah. I have that professor next semester. It's going to be interesting. But it's been a lot of fun. I really, both seminars that I took, read a lot of great books, got to enjoy some good papers, good discussions. And I know that some people might say I'm paid to say this, but I guess there's some truth to it. But I will say I think the church history faculty at Southern Seminary is still the gold standard. And I really am grateful for these men and to be in the program. But it's always interesting. Tomorrow's graduation. And then next week, it will look like the apocalypse happened around here, because there will be very few souls. And yours truly will be out of here next Friday for a couple weeks. I have never been more excited to go home to the Gulf than I am for next week, especially since winter has already hit here. And we're about to get even a more brutal taste of it this weekend.
Breathe that Gulf air.
That's right. The salt air, the sunshine. Yes, I'm ready.
You gotta get out of there before some more snow falls, though.
Yeah, but no, we're going to get snow tonight. We're going to get snow Saturday night. We had nearly 5 inches at the beginning of last week. So this has already been a really, I told somebody, I said, it probably means one of two things. Maybe we're just getting it early and we won't get hardly anything in January and February, or this is a foreshadowing of the Laura Ingalls book, The Long Winter. Well, Jesse, how are you doing? You look like you need some coffee.
That's the sad thing is, I think I'm beyond what coffee can do for me.
See, this is what I want people to see. When you are addicted to coffee, you look like Jesse. See, it doesn't even do anything for him. I don't need coffee. I just run on pure energy here. Just here.
Yeah. We're not all blessed with the level of energy that you have.
You know, get up in the morning and go run in the freezing cold and, you know, get that cold air in the lungs and, you know.
That's what you need. Yeah, I think, you know, and church and everything, it's a busy time of year for pastors. And then it's a very busy time of year for professors. And so bringing those together is it's always an interesting time. I'm through most of the grading. I have a Baptist ecclesiology class that I have to grade the papers that were turned in for that class just really recently. And when I finish those, I'm done for the semester. But each of those are about 15 to 18 pages. So I've still got to knock those out.
Why are you not having your intern do that?
That's a good idea. These are like a real labor of love. You got to put in, I try to put in a lot of effort into these papers and give a lot of feedback. So it takes me longer to grade them than it does some of the other papers.
If you can't share publicly, that's okay, because maybe some of your students listen to the podcast. They should. You should give extra credit. But what's been the best paper that you've had in that seminar?
I haven't read through all of them yet. So I couldn't say for sure. I do have one on the office of deacon in general and particular Baptist confessions, but looking specifically, maybe more closely at general Baptist, but general and particular Baptist. What I've seen of that one so far looks interesting. Then I had one that was taking a claim that is in the distinctiveness of Baptist covenant theology, that Thomas Grantham's covenant theology is consistent with the federal theology of the English particular Baptists. Mm-hmm. And so this student is trying to demonstrate that. So whereas in the book, it's kind of more of an assertion, because it's not the purpose of that book to demonstrate that, this student is trying to see if they can demonstrate that. It's only a 20, I think the student's paper is about 20 pages. So it's kind of a limited amount of space to demonstrate that. But that one looks good.
That sounds really, really fascinating. I'd love to read that.
Yeah, this student is going to do a larger project, I think, for, we have an MA in theology and ministry, but there's a thesis track, and they write about an 80 to 90 page thesis, something like that. So I think this student is going to try to expand this into a larger project for that. Yeah, so it should be, well, should be good.
Yeah, and so Jesse and I were a few weeks ago in Boston together, and we were at ETS. So today's episode is entitled Bacchus, McCall, and Monk, Oh My, because it's to reflect that kind of what we've been engaged in. Jesse did a paper at ETS on the General Baptist and their Trinitarian theology, coinciding with the Nicene Creed's 1700th anniversary. That was kind of the theme of ETS. And then I have this semester worked on a paper on Isaac Bacchus and then one on Duke McCall, two very, very different people. But we just kind of wanted to share about some of the things that kind of stood out to us in our research and writing. But we had a lot of fun in Boston a few weeks ago. A lot of memories were made. A lot of fun time with Dr. Willsey and others, things that we can't necessarily share all those stories here on the podcast, except to say that I just say this. Dr. Willsey is who you want in a professor and an advisor, because he will, on one hand, iron sharpens iron. And let me just tell you, you have not experienced life until you have read your seminar paper with him and going page by page through that paper, especially for me with my boss sitting in there to listen to that as well. And so that was quite an experience. But then a few weeks later, the time that Dr. Willsey invests to want to just spend time with his students, that's what it's about. And so just a lot of fun with him, had fun with Jesse, with Casey, McCall, and some others. It was interesting being up there in Boston. That was my first time. And now the roads and everything are laid out horribly there. I cannot imagine living in that city. But it had some really great food, saw a lot of great history. Jesse and I went to a kind of a famous used bookstore, and I actually found two books that are pertinent for my topic with Bacchus and stuff there. So that was really cool to find those. And it was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. We heard some good papers. Casey McCall did a great paper on Andrew Fuller and some of his political views. Dr. Willsey heard two good papers from him. And then Jesse did his paper, which was really good. And Jesse, kind of go into detail here about what you talked about. Tell us what you talked about. And then I know a lot of this stuff probably is like secondhand to you, but what was the most interesting thing you discovered in the research that you did for the paper?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I ran across anything that was entirely new. So the premise of the paper is that a lot of 20th and even 21st century histories that deal at all with the English General Baptist kind of present a narrative of theological decline. So they kind of start with Thomas Helwys and John Smith, and they kind of just move quickly on and say, well, in the 18th century, we obviously know that the English General Baptists, many of them embraced various anti-Trinitarian views, which I've challenged that particular point about the 18th century in some other stuff I've written. But the primary point of this paper was to say, if you adopt this kind of theological decline narrative, and sometimes historians do this to the point of almost completely discounting or overlooking the theological contributions, even Trinitarian contributions, that the General Baptists make in the 17th century. If you take this decline narrative, you miss a lot of really rich stuff that's there in the writings of Helwys, but even in Thomas Grantham and Thomas Monk and stuff that's in the confessional tradition as well. So that's kind of the foil, is the decline narrative overlooks or fails to see these important contributions. And so I do that, and then I try to say, why is this the case? Why do historians often do this. And several of the reasons are the controversy surrounding Matthew Caffin on the doctrine of the Trinity, which is something we've talked about on this show before, something that controversy kind of plagues the General Baptist for several decades. And so that's a big part. This is a very complex thing over a half of a century. But anyways, looking at the writings of Grantham, looking at the writings of Thomas Helwys, looking at the writings of Thomas Monk, and then the confessional tradition, what you find is they're very dependent on Nicene Orthodoxy and the Chalcedonian definition, sometimes directly appealing to those documents. And of course, in the case of the Orthodox Creed, they actually reprint the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, and the Apostles' Creed. And Thomas Grantham does something similar in his Christianismus Primitivus. And if you went all the way back to Thomas Helwys's Declaration of Faith of English People Remaining at Amsterdam in Holland from 1611, which is kind of their confession of faith when they come back from Amsterdam to England, you would see that Helwys uses really formal kind of creedal language in his exposition of the doctrine of the Trinity in that confessional statement. And so all of this just to say there is a rich kind of confessional and even creedal affirmation of the doctrine of the Trinity in among General Baptists in the 17th century. And we can overlook that if we just say, well, we all know that many of them embraced heterodox Christology or heterodox Trinitarian theology at some point in the 18th century. So that's kind of the primary thing that the paper was trying to achieve.
So would you say that the General Baptist issues that they had in the 17th century really is the classic tension in Baptist life that's marked us from the beginning of the pull between a biblicism and subscription?
I hate to call it biblicism, just because of the negative connotation that term often has. There is certainly a desire among Baptists, I think like there is among Puritans, to be biblical in the sense of they want to take the Christian tradition seriously, but they do believe that that the Bible, that Scripture is, Holy Scripture is, you know, our final authority, our final rule in faith and practice. So how they apply that differs from person to person and group to group. And you see this even among the General Baptists, where some are much more willing to employ technical creedal language and even reference the creeds in their confessional statements. And other General Baptists, while they would affirm those things, are less inclined to use extra biblical words and phrases in their creedal statements or in their confessional statements because they are hesitant to require people to subscribe to extra biblical words and phrases. So if they're going to require subscription, they want to use biblical language as much as possible. Now, other General Baptists would just say, well, these are the theological consequences of the Bible's teaching on the doctrine of God and of the incarnate Christ. And so because they think those things are consistent with the teachings of Scripture, then they're okay with using creedal language. So yes, I do agree that this is a tension that Baptists have had, you know, from the 17th century. They want to be biblical and stick with the teachings of the Bible, but also see value in the great Christian tradition and even in the ecumenical councils and creeds, specifically in, you know, Nicaea, Constantinople, and Chalcedon. They want to affirm those things, but as far as the application of them, there is variance among them. And as I said earlier, I don't know that that's just Baptist. I do think you see that same impulse among the Puritans and even among some of the early Reformed Orthodox writers as well. I think Bucer maybe is an example of this too. So it's not just a Baptist thing. I think it's there's this desire to there's this primitivist impulse, as it's sometimes described, to follow the teachings and sometimes even the language of scripture, and especially when you're requiring subscription to use biblical language wherever possible.
This might be a little bit of a curveball. I don't know if we've talked about this before or not, but I think you've written a chapter somewhere on this. The first Free Will Baptist that came to America, how would you describe them? Are they more in the Monk and the Grantham, or are they more the Caffin trajectory?
So the first General Baptist that came to America, is that what you said?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. The first General Baptist that came to America. Yes.
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. So in the South, in the Carolinas, we have this record in the minutes of the General Association of General Baptists. So to make sense of this, in the late 1690s, in 1696, the General Assembly of General Baptists, which has been the national gathering or body of General Baptists throughout England for about half a century, actually splits. And it splits over the controversy surrounding Matthew Caffin. So there's this group, particularly in and around London and a bit north of London, and probably spread some other places as well, they're much more in favor of using creedal language to defend the doctrine of the Trinity and to exclude those who might not affirm it. Well, because of some within the General Assembly who I think were orthodox on the doctrine of the Trinity, but hesitant to employ creedal language, they thought they hadn't done enough to exclude Caffin. So they actually split. And the group that splits off that wants to use more creedal language is the General Association of General Baptists. Well, in those minutes of the meetings of the General Association, you can actually find reference to a group of Baptists in the Carolinas that write to them requesting help. And what they're asking for are for them to send some books and things like that. And so those Baptists in the Carolinas are actually writing to the General Association, the more creedal group. So I do think that they wrote to the General Association instead of the General Assembly does tell us something. I think that's interesting. Now, if you look at some of the earliest General Baptist confessions, they do seem to follow the standard confession, or sometimes when it was first printed, it was called the Brief Confession of 1660. That was edited later by Thomas Grantham and some others. And that is that's the confession that was used by the General Assembly, not the General Association. Well, I take that back. From everything I can see, I suppose the General Association might have used it as well. But anyways, they didn't use an Orthodox creed or anything like that. They used the standard confession. But all that to say, the standard confession was more biblical in its language, less creedal in its language. And so the earliest confessions in the American context among Free Will Baptists or General Baptists use the standard confession. So we're more biblical in their language. But again, that connection with the General Association, which was more creedal in its defense of the doctrine, I do think that that's instructive in some sense of where they were at on these issues.
I always learn and I'm always educated and helped and appreciate the good scholarship that you do and trying to really be honest. And people think it's a cop-out if you say this, but it's not. But history requires us to do nuance. These things are often not as black and white as we like to make them, because to try to show the complexities requires us to not fall into caricatures or straw man. And it also requires us to kind of realize that all of us have our shortcomings and flaws in our traditions. So I always learn and appreciate from you when you're dealing with these topics.
I appreciate that. Yeah, when I'm reading the English General Baptist, are there certain things that I'm hoping to find or hoping are there? Yes. And I'm excited when I find them. But they're all, like in any tradition, or quite frankly, not even a tradition, even in a single figure. If a single figure wrote enough You'll find plenty of things that you think, man, I wish he or she had said that different, you know? So that's going to always be the case. I think what's important for us is, you know, we're never totally neutral observers. Again, we have hopes and
sure.
expectations and things we want to find and see. And so we're not entirely neutral, but it should be our aim. And I want it to be my aim to try to present the things I find in an honest way. So that means like when there are things that I wish were different, I still present those findings. Sometimes you have to emphasize a certain part of the historical record more than another in an attempt to kind of set the record straight, to bring about a little bit more balance. And that's kind of what I'm doing in this. But yeah, I think you're right. Part of being a good historian is dealing honestly with the people that we're engaging. You mentioned John Wilsey's papers, but he did one that dealt with his book on religious freedom and a conservative primer. And we read, I think, a section in there when we had our quartet episode recently. And he has a really good page or two in there where he talks about that, you know, dealing honestly, kindly, lovingly with the people that we're engaging. And I think that sort of sympathetic reading and understanding and presentation of history is essential, you know, to good history. But thank you for saying that.
Hey, Jordan here. Are you still running a house instead of being a homeowner? Well, I've got a great opportunity for you if that's you. In 2026, you can become a homeowner and I will give you the steps to get there. If you felt overwhelmed, if you felt like you don't know how to get there, if you felt like this isn't actually a reality or a possibility for me, you need to join me for my free online first-time home buyer seminar. It's perfect for renters, newlyweds, anyone curious about buying their first home. We're going to go over basic questions like why buy a home, why some don't buy, what lenders look for, how do you manage a down payment, what are closing costs, how do you leverage your buying power to the maximum ability, how do mortgage rates work, and a ton more. So if you want to learn what it looks like to buy a home with little to no money down, if you want to avoid expensive first-time buyer mistakes, come join me for this event. I'll put a link in the description of this episode. You can check it out. You're going to learn how much you can afford, how to qualify even with limited credit or savings, how to down payment assistance works, and much, much more. So if you've had questions, join me for this seminar. I'd love to see you there.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you threw shade at us at the beginning of your paper.
I didn't throw any shade at the particular Baptist.
Sure. Okay. So one of the interesting things about the time at ETS is you were in there too for this. Was a paper given by a gentleman on that I thought was very, very interesting. It was comparing and contrasting the theology of revolution between John Bunyan and Isaac Backus, which was kind of fascinating to listen to him talk about some of the Backus stuff because of what I worked on this semester, which was on Isaac Backus and a Baptist case for the American Revolution. I think one of the things that stood out to me that was most interesting to me in my research for this was, you know, I was aware of the Baptist that, including Backus and others, that went to Philadelphia to the First Continental Congress. And they end up having a meeting with John Adams and Sam Adams and others to kind of make the case for why disestablishment in Massachusetts needed to happen if they were going to be consistent in their desire for liberty and all those things. And so Backus is there for the Warren Association, and you also had some from the Philadelphia Association that were there as well. But the meeting did not go well. You know, John, this is where John Adams famously says, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, the likelihood of the solar system dissolving is greater than disestablishment happening in Massachusetts. tell you a little bit of the setting here. But Backus and the guys in the Warren Association were not ready to kind of quit in their engagement with the Patriot leaders. And I found it fascinating that after that meeting through 1774 and the beginning of 1775, where Backus and others are still engaging the Patriot leaders that the Philadelphia Association wrote to the Warren Association, kind of chiding them, saying, you need to kind of stop dialoguing and writing and engaging the Patriot leaders, because you're, in a sense, by you doing this continually, you're making them legitimate. You're saying that you view them as a legitimate government agency. And the Philadelphia Association, by this point, was almost had fallen back on a kind of neutrality, where they basically said, we've got to be in a position as Baptist to where whether the Patriots win or the King wins, that we kind of, you know, we can have a favorable audience with either group. The funny thing is then the shot heard around the world happens. And by the time Backus is going to write to the Philadelphia brethren, you know, everybody was on Team America by that point. But it was just kind of interesting to see that you can see kind of some distance between the Baptists in Massachusetts, the Warren Association in New England, and then the Baptists there in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, kind of going from visiting the Continental Congress to then maybe kind of pulling back a little. It was just really fascinating to see that in that context.
I wasn't there for that paper, but that sounds...
I'm glad you weren't there.
Really, that sounds really interesting. I did hear a couple of other... I heard quite a few good papers, but there were some other ones that I thought were really interesting. Greg Wills did a paper on whether or not the New Hampshire Confession is like a mediating document between Calvinism and Arminianism. And essentially what he says is it's highly influenced by Edwardsianism and kind of new divinity thought. So whereas later historians, and honestly, even some contemporary writers viewed it as a sort of mediating document, some to who were pleased with that, and then some who were opposed to that. His argument was essentially that it's a misunderstanding kind of Edwardsian theology and its influence among Baptists. Another thing that came up kind of related to that was Mike Brooks, who pastors not too far outside of Boston, who does some really great work. I've actually heard a paper from him last year and then again this year. He wrote on, at least in large part, I think, on Jonathan Maxey and the influence of new divinity thought on Jonathan Maxey. And I felt really embarrassed listening to the paper. I did not know until listening to his paper that Maxey was the first president of the University of South Carolina. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know how that had how I didn't know that, or maybe I had just forgotten. But when his paper was really interesting. But anyways, in there he was talking about Brooks Holyfield's theology in America, and Holyfield was Greg Wills's supervisor at Emory. And apparently Holyfield distinguishes, and probably rightly so, but he distinguishes between Edwardsian Baptist and kind of Fullerite Baptist. Hmm. And I thought for someone like Holyfield, especially doing such a big overview like theology in America is, that is a really fine grain distinction. I don't know. I was struck by that. It's been 10 or so years since I've read that, but it made me want to go back and look at that big Theology in America volume. But anyways.
Well, I'm just curious, what does Holyfield say the difference is between the two?
Well, I mean, I suppose he understood some, let me come at it another way. I suppose he was of the conviction that Fuller had, maybe though he was influenced some by Edwards, which he obviously was, hadn't adopted Edwards's views wholesale. So maybe there's a sense in which Edwards's theology was mediated through Fuller to some Baptists, right? And so therefore we might call them Fullerite, in that they hold Fuller's version or whatever he adopted from Edwards or whatever, however he was influenced from Edwards, which that could be a whole other conversation. Whereas there were some Baptists, and maybe Maxey is an example of that, who are more directly influenced by new divinity thought. So not Edwards mediated through Fuller, or even directly, you know, engaging Fuller, but maybe Edwards and new divinity thought more directly. And so maybe that affected their views on the atonement, whether we're thinking about theories of atonement or whatever it might be. I think that may be the best way of coming at the distinction. But in part, what I was saying is I want to look at Holyfield more and see, because I just didn't remember that. So it kind of left me thinking, I want to see how he details those differences. And maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't give a lot, but he does give both of those categories and distinguishes between them.
Yeah, I will say that it's interesting that you brought up about Maxey, because a good friend of mine that was here last week for the Southern Baptist History Seminar that I was in serves on staff at First Baptist Columbia, South Carolina. And I'm really, he's currently in the track he's doing as a modular PhD is more on the systematic side. I'm really trying to persuade him that he should just come on over to the church history, make that his primary thing. And I'm like, you know, I told him, I said, Jonathan Maxey would be somebody very interesting to do a dissertation on, that there needs to be work done on him. And what I enjoy about it is because some of Maxey's views made their way, a sermon of his made its way to London, and John Rippon reads it and is appalled. And Rippon has a correspondence, a relationship with Isaac Backus. And he writes to Backus and said, who is this man? Who is this? And in Alva Hovey's biography on Backus, he has these letters in the back. And when there's a letter that Backus writes to Maxey, where Backus rebukes Maxey essentially for what he had preached. And then Maxey, and this is where it gets kind of, you wonder, Maxey says, that's not what I believe. I kind of misspoke. I kind of got sloppy. But it's actually consistent, though, with new divinity stuff. It was essentially him kind of downplaying and denying Adamic imputation and the way that headship and sin. So yeah, that's, I think that's, the Maxey stuff's very interesting because of then the connection with Maxey to W.B. Johnson, who's the first president of the SBC, and that whole connection as well. And W.B. Yeah. Johnson is the most prominent Southern Baptist figure who embraces new divinity views, but he's an outlier. I mean, that's not common at all in Southern Baptist life at the beginning, but one of the most prominent people in the SBC holds to it, which is interesting. Dr. Wills sent me his paper today because he had told me to remind, he hadn't sent it to me yet, but he told me to remind him. So I sent him in Reiner, and he and I have talked about it a couple of times. I mean, I'm guilty of this. I've said before, because I've read people that I, you know, respect, who will talk about the New Hampshire Confession was like this response to hyper-Calvinism and kind of the primitive movement on one hand, anti-mission society movement on one hand, and then the rise of the Free Will Baptist, Benjamin Randall, and that kind of stuff. And, you know, he told me, he said, Jake, I don't see any of them talking about the Free Will Baptist. He said, so it can't be they're writing this in response to people they never talk about. They're not even on their radar.
I thought there were some things in that paper, again, that I hadn't thought about, or maybe I hadn't thought about in a long time. A couple of things that I thought were interesting points. One that I thought strengthened his view, and then one that I was kind of I'm not sure what to do with. The point that really strengthened his view is he talks about how Free Will Baptists in the North, and maybe he was thinking about a particular state, I really can't remember, but it was like something like 2% of church communicants or something like that. And so his point was like, that's a pretty small percentage to think that that was some massive influence that they felt like they needed to respond to. And I thought that was a strong point. What was interesting though, you know, you might read Lumpkin or McLaughlin or something like that in the early 20th century and say, Well, they don't really understand the context very well. So they see it as a mediating position between Arminianism and Calvinism. But that's in maybe in part because they don't fully understand the context. Maybe that's part of it. So that's an interesting point. However, he did point out that that even right after the New Hampshire Confession is written, there are critiques that it is a mediating document. And so so people in that exact time leveling that critique is an interesting point. You know, it's not just 20th century mm-hmm. historians who are saying that. There were people in that very time period who said that. And I thought that adds some interesting nuance.
Well, if I remember correctly, he talks about a church in Florida in the 1850s that adopted the New Hampshire, and their association was going to unseat them because they thought
they had basically embraced Arminianism or were like Arminianized. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was Florida, but he does talk about that. Yeah, that they were basically going to be disfellowshipped from the association from adopting this Arminianized confession. So again, like, that's not to say that that it is a mediating document. It's just, it does add some interesting complexity and texture to say, no, there were people in this time period who thought that. It's not just later histories.
Well, we're almost out of time. I just really want to make a quick comment that the other paper that I did this semester was on Duke McCall and his attempt at forging a Southern Baptist consensus. And I had a lot of fun in the sense that because Southern Seminary houses all of his papers. So I was able to go in archives and spend a Friday three hours in there with my phone, taking pictures and just going through his files. So getting to kind of do some archival work like that was fun. Kind of my first time research.
I thought the privilege of a position like yours would be that you just like get to take that stuff home or something.
No,
the person who ever sees those might have smacked those out of your hands.
Yeah, it would have been a challenge to do that. But I had a lot of fun doing this. And one of the things that I was trying to communicate and I got in the feedback was that even if I have disagreements with McCall, an appreciation and being in awe in a sense of really how he tried to be a statesman. It's kind of fascinating. The man was, up until a couple of years ago, the longest serving president of Southern Seminary. And I know he just died, would be 12 years ago now, but there has been no scholarly work done on him at all. Like no monographs, no dissertations, really no journals. And one of the things, pure speculation, when Roy Honeycutt died, a lot of the more moderate Baptist historical journals did devoted a whole journal to Roy Honeycutt. That does not exist for McCall. And I think the reason is because a reason there's been very little done on McCall is conservatives think, well, he was a lib, so why should I care about him? But then moderates and libs saw him as a traitor because he did have a good relationship with Dr. Moeller. He and his son gave a sizable endowment gift, 15 years into the Moeller administration. And so I think that's one reason they didn't do anything is because he's kind of like, you know, he really wasn't one of us. So anyway, I just really enjoyed reading him. I was frustrated by him at times, but he made this statement that this was in 1985, and he's writing this in Jerry Falwell's The Fundamentalist. That's the name of the journal, was The Fundamentalist. And he said, "I would like to be a moderate in temperament, a conservative in theology, and fundamentalist in my commitment to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." You know what? In a lot of ways, I can embrace those sentiments. And I think in some ways, having grown up in a more fundamentalist environment, I appreciate the desire. Moderate doesn't mean you're squish. It means to me in that sense that you are trying to be a consensus builder and also respect people. So anyway, I had a lot of fun with that and thought it was just, if I weren't going to do a dissertation on Backus, I would think about doing one on McCall because nothing's been done and we have everything here. And you don't serve at Southern Seminary for over 30 years. He was also the president that made New Orleans Baptist Seminary into a seminary. The man, and he lived nearly 100 years. So, you know, very influential. Graduated from here with Herschel Hobbs and W.A. Criswell. Those three men were all, you know, here at the same time, which that's another dimension that's very interesting.
That's
too.
Interesting. What would you say your kind of primary takeaway from all that research is? I mean, I love the quote that you gave, and I think we're both in agreement. It's a nice balance.
Yeah, I think I know we're not supposed to make application as historians. We're supposed to stay.
No, this is actually the appropriate place for that.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing, what I tried to bring out, is that McCall's consensus had three components. The authority of the Bible, I mean, he's very strong in his understanding of what does that mean. But then soul competency, that everybody has a right to interpret the Bible. And if you prize the Bible and if you prize interpretation, then that leads to cooperation, denominational cooperation for missions and so forth. He beats that drum over and over and over. If you love the Bible, then you'll love interpreting the Bible. You'll love one another in Christ. You'll respect one another in Christ. You can differ, but because of your love, and then a love for the church, a love for souls, a love for winning the lost, we can work together. The issue for him, and the problem with that model, is if you do not have a real confessional consensus, then it's not going to work. And he really has this. It's very Mullins-esque. He quotes Mullins all the time on soul competency, and he's very Mullins-esque in his suspicion of creeds and subscription. He thinks that's the problem with the Southern Baptist, the conservative resurgence that happens, is it becomes this mechanism of creedalism. But one of the things I pointed out is that he had something that he did in mid-70s where he's inconsistent, because he has this address he writes out entitled Baptist Orthodoxy. And he said it begins with an adherence to the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message. Now, I think that's the worst version of the BFNM. But he is talking about some kind of subscription. And then he goes on to talk about, he said, I challenge anybody to find where I have contradicted the abstract or where I've contradicted the 1925, the 1963 BFNM. Everything that I believe is consistent with those documents. So that there was at least one time where he's trying to use a sense of confessionalism to bolster his arguments. But I again think he was a product of what came out of this institution really in the New South era, of that period between 1900 and 1940, which was a love for the Bible. I think the man loved the scriptures. I do not doubt that at all. But such an emphasis on that concept of soul competency, and you cannot have a balanced view of soul competency apart from some type of confessionalism.
Yeah, there has to be
will
some
not
sort of,
work.
Has to be some sort of norm governing, boundary.
There has
sort.
To be.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds well, good. We hope everybody enjoyed our kind of a tour here of research we've been doing this semester. We hope everybody continues to enjoy the month of December. I hope that we get to record once more before Christmas. I don't know, but if we don't, we say Merry Christmas. It's crazy to think about that we're at that time of the year. A Happy New Year. And I know that there's going to be some people that want to know if we have any opinions, and I'll just say, hey, Bama's in the playoffs. I have no idea what'll happen, but we got in, and it's worth it knowing that Notre Dame was saddened. So hey, roll time.
It's worth it knowing that Notre Dame, Vanderbilt, Tennessee, and some others are not in.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna close this. You know, I always have closed these things for a long time now with Stay Baptist. But I had a friend of mine say this, and I think we're gonna do it this way now. Be Baptist. Be Baptist, my friends.
Be Baptist.
I'll have to tell Jordan.